Well, thanks for that introduction, and good evening. You are awake. You are allowed to talk about this evening. I'll try that one again. Good evening.
Good evening.
See, I'm British. I have a natural sense of inferiority. So if you don't respond when I say something hopefully funny, I will probably go and, you know, sort of get the next plane out of here. As Bill said, it's a miracle that I'm here and really sort of literally rushed off the plane, so excuse the slightly disheveled appearance. We thought we'd have in about an hour between landing and actually getting here, but Air Canada had other ideas, and the weather as well. I suppose we shouldn't blame the airline, although somebody pointed out to me that Air Canada's company slogan is Air Canada, we're not happy until you're not happy. So this evening, what we're going to do over the next 40 minutes or so is address this this topic that they've asked me to talk a little bit on, of why I'm not an atheist. As you probably heard in the introduction, and you'll be aware of, I'm sure, because hopefully you've been sort of praying for it, we've got a number of events at the university this week, including a dialogue with a leading atheist member of faculty tomorrow, who's very generously agreed to give us some of his time. So we're doing a lot of engaging this week with others who think differently. So rather than a sort of more traditional sermon, I'm basically going to treat you folks this evening like university audience. So the talk that I'm giving tonight is a talk I've regularly given on university campuses, I regularly give in front of non-Christians. So that means a number of things. It means, if you're sitting here this evening and you are a disciple of Christ, as many of you are, then hopefully you can listen with one ear open, thinking, maybe I can use some of this material with atheist friends that I come across. Or maybe you're sitting here this evening and actually you're not quite sure what you believe. Because one of the things I always find interesting is, in a congregation of about this size, there are often people who are struggling with issues of faith and Christian faith and just haven't had the opportunity to admit that. And if that describes where you are this evening, then I hope some of what you hear will be helpful, offer some food for thought, and when it comes to the questions, you can then fire really difficult ones at me, and Bill will answer them. We are going to go at a relatively high speed this evening, a lot of material to get through. We're going to make the PowerPoint slides available. I haven't told Bill this, but I'll make them available. So if you are the kind of person who likes to try and keep notes and try and keep up with the speaker, you might find that the speed I go causes you to set fire to your notepad, and you might just want to sort of relax, get the overall flow of the event, and then grab the slides later. Well, those housekeeping announcements aside, why don't I open in prayer, and then we'll dive into why I'm not an atheist. Father God, we thank you that we can gather together this evening as this small representative of your global body of Christ. Lord, thank you that today, on this Lord's Day, millions upon millions upon millions of our brothers and sisters in Christ are worshiping you in different time zones, different countries, all around the world. And we thank you that we have the freedom here in Canada to gather together without fear of persecution to worship you and to learn about you. But Lord, we also recognize that we live in a secular age when many of our friends, our neighbors, our family, our colleagues, our classmates do not believe the things that we do. And Lord, there is thus a terrific responsibility on us as followers of Christ to think through the challenges to faith so that we can, as your word commands us to, be ready to give a reason for the hope that we have. So Lord, this evening I pray, would you give us listening ears, thinking minds, open hearts, and would you speak to each one of us this evening? And would you also, as I speak, bring to mind for my brothers and sisters here, family members, friends, colleagues, classmates who are atheists, so that we don't talk about our atheist friends in the abstract, but we think of particular people that you've placed on our heart to reach. Pray all that in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, the title I've been given is a pretty amazing one. Why I am not an atheist. I love to do this on university campuses because it's a nice, gentle, non-confrontational topic and it doesn't, you know, generate any controversy. I am joking. It usually brings out. I first did this talk that I'm doing this evening at McGill University in Montreal, and it was really interesting because there were three groups in the audience that night. There was all the Christians who'd organized it down the front, which is unusual, but I figured there were no Baptists because they'd have been at the back. And then behind them were all the Muslims because they'd come out, I think, thinking, well, maybe there will be some useful things we can use. And then at the back, the secular society had come out in force, and they sat there through my entire talk like this. Half of them wore dark glasses for some reason. It was like an episode of Men in Black. And then when the questions came, my word, did some zingers come from the back row. So I'm just keeping an eye on the back row this evening, but I don't think the Secular Society are here, which is a shame because I love engaging with my atheist friends. And you see, here's the thing. This is a hugely important topic because too many of us at times live in a kind of Christian bubble. We have Christian friends, we read Christian books, we listen to Christian music, and we forget that in the world outside these doors, atheism is very much growing rapidly. You can see that in the culture, you can see that in the media, you can see that through some of the best-selling books that have been sold over the last few years. Atheist writers are now selling millions upon millions and millions of copies of their books. Atheism is very much on a kind of growth curve. You could even find atheism on the side of buses. Yes, even buses. There was a secular bus advert that did the rounds of many major cities in the last few years. This bus advert started in London, England, and then it went to New York, went to Washington, and it's been in Toronto, and it's been in Vancouver. There's probably no God, so stop worrying and enjoy your life. Some of you are chuckling at that. It's very interesting. We could talk about that in the Q&A, what we think of that slogan. All of that tells us, though, that, as I say, atheism is more popular, it's more confident, it's more out there. And those bus ads, like that one, really typify, I think, what's come to be termed the new atheism. Some of you who are perhaps more engaged in perhaps the university scene, if there are any students here this evening, may have heard that term. The term new atheism was coined by Wired magazine, a very popular kind of cultural magazine, back in 2006. And one of the journalists coined the term the new atheism to describe the kind of group of media-savvy new atheists, men like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, and Christopher Hitchens. That's not Santa Claus on the end, by the way. That is Daniel Dennett there. And their books, if you add up their sales together, have sold something like 20 million copies, promoting their atheist worldview. Now, why is this type of atheism called the new atheism? Well, not so much because of its arguments. If you read the writings of these men and others like them, they're not new arguments. The arguments have been around for decades. But what is new is the tone. It's very sarcastic, it's very cutting, it's very angry. There's a real anger in the new atheism. And it's often been asked, I mean, why is that there? Why are these guys so kind of polemical, so angry, so vitriolic? And I think the answer is really this. God is supposed to not be around anymore. As far back as 1966, Time magazine could slap this question on its cover. Is God dead? And the implication was very much the answer was yes. And so many atheists in the 1960s were looking forward to a kind of great secular utopia. We were supposed to be living in this kind of secular enlightened age in the 21st century. No religion, no faith, no church. You and I are not supposed to be here, quite frankly. But we are. And you know what? Rumors of God's death have been greatly exaggerated. Religion shows no sign of disappearing. And I think that failure of religion, as it were, to kind of roll over and die has left many, many atheists pretty angry. You know, what is it that makes Richard Dawkins furious as he sits in his ivory tower there in England, in Oxford University? It's the fact that Christianity is growing in China. Christianity is growing in Africa. There's even a revival now in France with churches that were once empty filling up again. And things may be tough here in Canada, but in many parts of the world, Christianity is growing rapidly, as are other religions. God is not going away. In fact, only about 2% of people in the world would self-describe as atheist. And that number is actually declining at the moment, not going up. All that to be said, here in the West, atheism has gained a lot of traction with books like Richard's. They're selling really, really well, huge numbers of copies. And I think one of the reasons that books like his have sold so much is that for a long time it's been quite tough being an atheist here in the West. I have a considerable sympathy for my atheist friends. It can be hard being an atheist if everyone around you, your entire culture, is religious. And so there's been a bit of a pushback from our atheist friends. But that has significantly changed the culture. And now if you open the newspapers, turn on the television, you probably won't have missed the fact that atheism is often portrayed as being cool and trendy and hip. It's what you do if you're intelligent. If you're intelligent and savvy and kind of with it, a mover and a shaker, you're going to be an atheist. Whereas if you're an old fuddy-duddy, like me and like you, you're going to be a Christian and go to church. Atheism has a kind of momentum behind it. But for all of that, I think the claims of atheism don't stand up. And hence the title of this evening's talk, Why I Am Not an Atheist. But before we come to that, it's really interesting, really helpful, I think, to ask a question to begin with. And the question I want us to think about for 4 or 5 minutes is this. What is atheism? What actually is atheism? I've thrown that term around, but what does atheism actually mean? Well, here things get very interesting. Some of my atheist friends wish to claim that atheism is merely the absence of belief in God. Let me give you an example. Christopher Hitchens, who's no longer with us, he died a few years ago, but one of the most famous atheists of the last 15 years, wrote this. He said, "Our belief is not a belief." Are you convinced? Our belief is not a belief. You have to get your head around that one a little bit, track with that. And then one of the evangelistic, sort of enthusiastic atheists who hangs out on my Twitter feed and occasionally lobs hand grenades into the conversation posted this last year. He said, "Atheism isn't a claim. Atheism is a non-belief. It's just a non-belief in the claim there is a God." Now, many atheists I meet on university campuses love stressing this. Why? Because if this is true, they haven't got to defend anything. If atheism is simply the absence of belief in God, they have no arguments to produce. They haven't got to do anything. It's us religious types who need to produce arguments. They can sit there smugly and laugh at us. But there's a problem. There's a problem with the idea that atheism simply means the lack of belief in God. If that's all that atheism is, it leads to some very bizarre conclusions. It would mean, for example, that a hippopotamus would be an atheist because hippos don't believe in God. It would mean that small rocks would be atheists because they don't believe in God. And the list goes on. Rubber chickens, plants, bits of wood, Richard Dawkins' left foot. The list goes on and on and on. If atheism simply means the lack of a belief in God, well, then we end up with that bizarre conclusion. It simply can't be right. There must be something more going on. And I think there is, and we can demonstrate it. We can demonstrate it like this. Atheism functions for many people as an identity marker. Many people self-describe as atheists in the way that people who disbelieve in the tooth fairy don't. I imagine many of you here this evening, in fact, I'd be surprised if any of you here this evening believe in the tooth fairy. Does anyone here believe in the tooth fairy? Fantastic. There's always one person who wrecks my illustration by sticking their hand up and we have to throw them out. Okay, great. All of you, like me, don't believe in the tooth fairy. Tell me, when was the last time that any of you walked into a social setting and introduced yourself as an A-tooth-fairian? Anyone ever done that? Anyone said, "Hi, I'm Andy. I'm an A-tooth-fairian." I have never done that in my entire life. I have never used my lack of belief in the tooth fairy as an identity marker, as the way to define myself. Yet my atheist friends use their lack of belief in God exactly that way. They describe themselves as atheist. They proudly write "free thinker" on their Facebook profile, and the more enthusiastic ones change their Twitter profile to pictures of the flying spaghetti monster, for those of you who are aware of this particular badge of atheism. Furthermore, atheists are showing a tendency to gather together in communities centered around their atheism. A few years ago, the first atheist church started in London, back in England, an atheist church, where they get together on a Sunday morning, they sing happy little songs like Stevie Wonder's Superstition is a favorite, they hear a talk on science, and they sit around and drink tea and biscuits, just like Baptists, but without God. There are now atheist churches springing up in New York, in Washington, in Vancouver, in Toronto. There is even one in Halifax. I found out just this last weekend. There is the first atheist church has come here to the Maritimes. And that makes me scratch my head. Because if atheism is simply the absence of a belief in God, how on earth can it form communities like that? It has to be something more going on. It really, really does. And the more you look at it, the more you poke it with a stick, the more that it seems to me that atheism is actually functioning like a belief system. It's a belief system, just like Christianity or Hinduism or Buddhism or Islam or any of those other kind of world religions. Islam is a belief system as much as any other worldview. And so if that's the case, my atheist friends have at the very least some arguments to advance. Well, could we go even further? It's one thing to say that atheism is a belief system. Could we go so far as saying that atheism is actually a religion? That's a wonderful controversial topic. I tell you, if I pose that question on something like Facebook or Twitter, for those of you who are into social media, I get leapt upon by atheists all around and sort of things thrown at me. How dare you say that atheism is a religion? It's not a religion. Well, some scholars, some sociologists think that it is. on the screen behind me is a quote from a gentleman called Stephen Prothero. He is a leading sociologist of religion based at Boston University, and he thinks that at least some forms of atheism can be described as a religion. Listen to this professor's words. He says, "Atheism is a religion of sorts, or it can be. Many atheists are quite religious, holding their views about God with the conviction of zealots and evangelizing with verve. It stands at the center of their lives. It defines who they are, how they think, and with whom they associate. The question of God is never far from their minds." In fact, as one other scholar put it, nobody talks as much about God as people who don't believe in him. Very, very interesting. So can atheism be described as a religion? Well, I think so. You see, simple disbelief in God doesn't make you non-religious. There are actually quite a lot of religions in the world that don't believe in God. Forms of Buddhism, for example, Confucianism, some forms of Judaism, and large amounts of the Anglican Church. you are allowed to laugh. I'm an Anglican, by the way, so I can pick on them. So if that's what's going on then, what does religion mean? If it doesn't mean belief in God, what is religion? Well, another very famous sociologist called Emil Durkheim made this definition a few years ago now. He said, "A religion is a unified system of beliefs and practices relative to sacred things." So it's a set of kind of beliefs and practices and actions centered around sacred things. And then he went on to clarify. He said, "Sacred things don't need to mean God or supernatural beings. Sacred things can be anything that somebody holds important." And if that's the case, atheism looks very much like a religion. Well, there's one other observation here that will angle where I'm going to go for the next 20 minutes or so. Another way of thinking about a religion that I often use with my atheist friends is to say a very good definition of a religion is a kind of belief system or a system of thought that attempts to answer ultimate questions. There are some pretty big questions that keep philosophers up at night and off the streets and where they can cause harm. And one of the four of the questions that philosophers love to argue about are the four questions on the screen behind me. There's the question of origin. Where did we come from? There's the question of meaning. What is the purpose of life? That's a question that many of you will ask yourselves increasingly frantically as this talk rolls on. There's the question of morality. You know, where do we get good and evil from? And there's the question of destiny. Is this life all that there is, and does it really matter? And I would argue that any system of thought, be it a faith-based one in God or be it atheism, that tries to answer these questions is functioning as a religion. Well, let me say a few words about each of these questions for a moment. And as I do so, I think you'll begin to see why it is that I'm not an atheist and very much a follower of Jesus Christ this evening. Let me show you what happens if we try and answer these four questions, either using the Christian faith or using atheism, and see how persuaded you are. The origins question, let's start there. The origins question is fascinating. Where do we come from? Where does our universe come from? Why are we here? Those are questions that have occupied philosophers and thinkers for millennia. Why is there something rather than nothing? Are you, as a human being this evening, are you just a collection of atoms and chemicals and particles, or are you worth more than that? Those are hugely important questions. And as I say, that question of origins has driven philosophy and science for a long time. As human beings, we're obsessed with trying to answer that question. We build giant space telescopes to stare out into the heavens. We build amazing electron microscopes to peer into the atom in order to try and answer these kind of questions. Interestingly, we're of course the only animal that does that. The science writer Lauren Eisley, who is by no means a Christian, wrote this once. He said, "Mankind is the cosmic orphan. We're the only creature that asks why." In other words, rabbits don't sit around and have philosophical conferences and ask about the meaning of rabbithood. You don't see fish sort of gather in schools and go, "How do we solve the great questions of existence?" Human beings do. It's something that's unique about us. So how does atheism answer the origins question? Well, if you're an atheist, you would want to answer the question of origins by saying, well, whatever the answer to what we're doing here, no God was involved. All that exists, say my atheist friends, are atoms and particles. All that matters is matter. And thus, you have to answer the origin question in those terms. So most atheists would be comfortable with an answer that runs like this. They would say, well, perhaps about 14 billion years ago, the universe began. We don't quite know how. In fact, some physicists think that the universe popped into existence just from nothing. So there's a very famous physicist called Stephen Hawking. You may have heard of him. He's world famous. There's been a movie about him. And that's how he answers the origins question. He says the universe just began. This is what he says. He says, because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. So one day, no universe. Next day, pop, there's a universe. Well, of course, those of you who are still awake at this point in the evening may be looking at this, scratching your heads and saying, yeah, but Stephen, where did the law of gravity come from? The law of gravity isn't quite nothing. The law of gravity is a rather suspicious something. And I sometimes wonder whether some of my atheist friends need to read a little bit wider in philosophy. Because one of the most basic principles of philosophy is that something cannot come from nothing. Things do not simply appear. If they did, you might log on to your bank account this morning, tomorrow, looking forward to the appearance of millions of dollars in your bank account overnight. If I believed that something came from nothing, perhaps I would look out of my window tomorrow morning, expecting to see a large unicorn having materialized on the lawn, if things came from nothing. But they don't. Things require a cause. Well, for Hawking and others like him, the story goes like this. The universe, they believe, appeared from nothing. We'll just grant them that one for a moment. And then eventually our galaxies formed, and then our solar system, and then life emerged, slowly evolving into more and more complex forms of life, from single-celled amoebas to fishes and amphibians and real estate agents, and finally human beings up there at the top of the chain. You can always tell if there are actually real estate agents in the church, because again, things get thrown. On this view of reality, of course, human beings are just another animal. You are no more special than the ant or the aardvark or the amoeba or the antelope. We're just another animal. We're also merely physical, if atheism is true. There's no soul, there's no spirit, there's no mind inside you. You are just a walking, talking collection of atoms. Now again, if you're tracking with this, you may be sitting there thinking, that's a pretty bleak answer. Because there are some things that flow from that. If you genuinely believe that's all that human beings are, there are some problems that flow from that. One of the problems that comes out of that, if you believe that human beings are simply the product of time plus chance plus natural selection, if you believe that we are just a collection of atoms, one of the problems you have comes when you try to explain the human mind. Listen to these words that Charles Darwin wrote in a letter to a friend. So Charles Darwin, the very famous discoverer of the theory of evolution, also saw some problems with it. And he wrote this in a letter to a friend a few years before his death. He writes, "With me, the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of men's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone trust in the convictions of a monkey's mind if there were any convictions in such a mind?" In other words, what he's getting at, if you and I are the result of just millions upon millions of years of natural selection, of evolution, how can we trust our minds? Because our minds haven't been designed with truth in mind. They are simply the result of unguided forces churning away. And you wouldn't ask a monkey its opinion on philosophy. You wouldn't ask a rabbit to give you its a theory of economics. Well, why trust our minds? Why assume that there is something special about the human mind? There's no reason to do that. In fact, another biologist, a few years after Darwin, put it even more bluntly. J.B.S. Haldane, who was a very famous British biologist, not a Christian, but a real iconoclast. He loved attacking anything. He attacked religion, he attacked atheism, you name it, he went for it. But I think he nails it beautifully when he wrote this. He said, "If my mental processes are determined wholly by the motion of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to believe that my beliefs are true. They may be sound chemically, but that does not make them sound logically." Again, think that one through for a moment. If an atheist wishes to say that his mind is merely a collection of atoms, how do we get truth out of such a mind? In other words, on atheism, what's going on between your ears right now are a lot of chemicals fizzing. But we don't look at a chemical reaction in the laboratory and say, is it true or is it false? It simply is. And thus the atheist ends up in this very bizarre position where he or she ends up cutting off the branch that they're sitting on. Because you can't live as if your mind isn't reliable. Yet atheism leads you to conclude that you can't trust your mind. And thus you have to basically live as if atheism is false. Which tells me that it basically is. So, that's the question of origins. Let's talk for a few minutes about the question of meaning. So the question of origin, we've seen how atheism really struggles to answer that question. The question of meaning, let's talk about that for a moment. Is there a meaning to life? Is there a purpose to our existence? We ask ourselves that question in Toronto every time the Leafs play, I tell you. And now, consistent atheism would say there is none, period. Really, if you're a consistent atheist, you have to say there is no meaning to life. Why? Because we are just brief sparks in the infinite blackness. There were millions of years before you, there were millions of years after you. You live, if you're lucky, if you're 70 years, then you will die, your children will die, your grandchildren will die, the human race will one day go extinct, one day the sun will expand and swallow the earth, and one day the universe will come to an end, empty and dark and cold and alone, just like Saskatchewan. I do that joke differently over there, I must say. That raises some pretty bleak conclusions. In fact, so bleak that some atheists have begun trying to talk about meaning. You know, it's pretty hard to live your life as if that is reality. And so many atheists have started talking and describing it this way. They say, well, okay, there's no meaning built into the universe. The universe doesn't really have any meaning, but do you know what? We can create meaning. We can invent our own meaning. We can kind of make it up for ourselves. And I hear that all the time from young atheists who want to tell me, nah, there's no meaning built into life, but I am clever enough and smart enough, I can create my own purpose to life. Well, there's a problem with that. Let me illustrate. Imagine that you and I are going for a walk down here through the town, perhaps tomorrow. Perhaps you give me a tour around your subdivision, and we turn a corner in the street, and we come across a tree like this one with a huge pile of leaves outside. I ought to have said a huge pile of snow to really contextualize it, but a huge pile of leaves. And I turn to you and I say, hey, what's the meaning of that pile of leaves? Now, if you were thinking straight, you would look at me and you'd say, what a bizarre question. Don't they teach you to think in England? You wouldn't be so rude, you're Canadian. But what's the meaning of that pile of leaves? That's a nonsensical question. It's just a pile of leaves. It doesn't have any meaning. It's a stupid question. It's just a pile of leaves. It just is. And you'd be absolutely right. We might choose to use it for something. We could use it as a bed. We might use it to make a bonfire. Perhaps we might spray paint it pink and sort of make a modern art installation there on the street. But those are all uses, those are all purposes that we have given to the pile of leaves. They've come from outside, not within. The pile of leaves itself has no purpose. It's needed us to give it a purpose. Do you see what I'm saying? And the same goes for human life. If human life has no built-in purpose, if we are just collections of atoms and particles, then there is no meaning to life. And it doesn't matter how much my atheist friends jump up and down and scream that they can make their own meaning, they simply isn't one. In fact, if you think you can make your own meaning, if you think you can shout at the universe and say, I'm clever enough to make my own meaning, you hit a problem that was picked up by the poet Stephen Crane, a very famous poet a few years ago, who wrote this little verse. He said, a man said to the universe, sir, I exist. However, replied the universe, that fact has not created in me a sense of obligation. In other words, the universe doesn't care about you, full stop. You can say what you want. You're still going to get squished eventually. There's a further problem too, of course, with the idea on atheism that you can make up your own meaning. And of course, the problem is this. Let's suppose that you try and make up your own meaning, and I make up my meaning, and my meaning contradicts yours. Let's say that you decide that your meaning to life is going to be to save as many baby seals as possible. You're an environmentalist. You love baby seals. They're furry and cute. They look so lovely, and you don't like the seal hunts and the way they're treated sometimes. So you decide you're going to become an environmentalist, and you're going to save as many baby seals as possible. I decide, on the other hand, I'm going to club as many of the furry little critters to death as possible and make money selling their pelts for gloves. We have a problem. Your meaning to life and my meaning to life contradict. Who wins? Who do we decide? Presumably, the person who's the strongest. And I have a great big club, so I think I'm going to win. All of that's profoundly counterintuitive. You can't live like that. That kind of conclusion, that there is no built-in meaning to life, is so bizarre that it looks intuitively wrong. In fact, as one philosopher once put it, if the conclusions that you draw from your starting point, from your argument, are so bizarre that you can't live them out, there is something wrong with your starting point, and you ought to start all over. So we've looked at the question of meat of origins very quickly. We've looked at the question of morality, two down, two to go, and then we'll have some time for some Q&A. So origins, meaning, let's talk about morality for a few moments and how that looks on atheism. Well, despite a few brave attempts by a few enthusiastic atheists, most atheists that I encounter struggle somewhat with the question of morality, the question of good and evil. Here's Richard Dawkins, everyone's favorite cuddly English atheist, and he writes this fairly bleak paragraph in one of his books. He says, "The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no good, no evil, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference." You feeling encouraged? You feeling affirmed? You feeling excited and ready to get out of bed in the morning reading that? Isn't it good, hearty stuff? But there's a problem, as there always is, with this kind of extreme pessimism. If Dawkins is right, it raises the question, why are human beings so concerned with moral questions? We probably argue about morality as human beings more than any other subject. What's right? What's wrong? What should you do? What should you not do? It's the kind of thing that keeps most of us going. How do you explain that if Dawkins is right and the universe is simply pitiless and indifferent? Well, in an attempt to answer that, many atheists have tried to take the route of saying, well, you know what, morality doesn't really exist. It's just a trick played on us by our genes. It's just our DNA tricking us into thinking that there's morality, so we do the right thing. Other atheists have turned in the direction of relativism and said, well, there is no morality, but you make up your morality, a bit like you make up your meaning. You decide what's right, you decide what's wrong, and if you're strong enough and powerful enough, you can inflict your morality on somebody else. But the one thing, whatever route you take, the one thing that is not open to you, I would argue, if you're an atheist, is to say there is actual right, actual wrong, genuine morality. Because all that exists are atoms and particles, and those things can't impose an ought on us. It's very hard to see how you can get from atheism to morality. Now, there are huge problems, of course, for atheism here. One of them is simply that, of course, all of us have a very innate, instinctive experience of morality. I suggest that most of us, when we opened the newspapers 10 days, 2 weeks ago, when we read the story of those attacks in Paris, the Charlie Hebdo killings, I suspect that nobody here really went, well, that's just the universe being pitilessly indifferent. Most of us probably heard those stories and went, that's wrong, that's unjust, something should be done. I suspect none of us read the stories of those killings in Paris and went, well, you know what? It's okay for the Islamists to do that. That's their morality. That's lovely. They can go and kill people. I don't mind. It's not for me. I suspect none of you reacted that way. All of us instinctively went, no, that's actually wrong. We instinctively know there is such a thing as good and evil. But the problem is, if you are a consistent atheist, it's very hard to see how you can get there. In fact, the famous Canadian philosopher Kai Nielsen put it beautifully when he said, pure practical reason, even with a good knowledge of the facts, will not get you to morality. You can't get to good and evil based on reasoning, atheistic reasoning alone. We need something deeper. So the question of origins, the question of meaning, the question of morality, one last area, and then we'll bring this into land and have some time for some questions. That's the question of destiny. Where ultimately are we headed? It's a question that many people spend a lot of time lying awake at night reflecting on. Where ultimately are we headed? Well, atheism has a pretty bleak answer here. What's waiting for each one of you is death and destruction and then non-existence. All of us here are destined, quite frankly, to be worm food. And even if you take the cremation route, you're basically a worm barbecue. No escape that way. That's where you're headed if atheism is true. There is no afterlife. There is no survival beyond the grave. It doesn't matter whether you're a saint or a sinner. For every single human being, you are facing death and destruction and oblivion. And, says atheism, the same holds true for the universe. Because one day the universe will come to an end and everything will be over, the great full stop. Now, it doesn't take a lot of thinking about that before you very quickly end up in a pretty bleak place. One of the most famous atheists of the 20th century was a gentleman called Bertrand Russell. He was another English atheist. We have made many English atheists in our time in my home country. We've succeeded in exporting atheism and financial chaos. We're doing really, really well. We'll try and do better this century. Bertrand Russell wrote this. This is a very long quotation, but if you can, I want you to really try and track with it and listen to the angst and the despair as this paragraph goes on. He's trying to reflect on what it really means to be an atheist when you realize what's coming. He writes these powerful words. He says, "Our hopes and our fears, our loves and our beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms. No fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. All the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and the whole temple of man's achievements must inevitably be buried beneath the ruins of beneath the debris of a universe in ruins." In other words, he's saying it doesn't matter how clever we get as individuals, as society, everything that we construct and we build and we put together as human beings, the whole thing is destined to come crashing down and we will lie buried beneath its ruins. We cannot change that. That is what awaits us. The question I have to ask my atheist friends is that livable? Can you actually go through your life living that out as if you really believe it? And the simple answer is no. I don't think you can. This is not simply a question of comfort. It's really a question of whether you want to bother making a difference. You see, if Bertrand Russell is true, it has the horrifying implication that it doesn't matter what you do now. You think your choices matter, but actually your choices make no difference at all because the outcome is exactly the same. Help your next door neighbor across the street or club her over the head and steal her pension book. It makes absolutely no difference. Live your life to help others or be completely self-centered and selfish. Makes no difference, Bertrand Russell would say. The outcome is exactly the same. And as the Russian writer Fyodor Dostoevsky, very, very famous novelist, famously put it at the turn of the 19th century, he said, "If there is no God, anything is permissible. You can behave exactly as you like, do exactly as you wish. It simply doesn't matter." Origin, meaning, morality, destiny. Those are four little words, four little questions that have huge consequences. There are huge questions with important answers, and we've seen how atheism fails to answer any of them. Not merely, in fact, does atheism fail to answer those questions, I would also say that atheism has some pretty dreadful consequences. Terrifying consequences actually flow if atheism is true. To name just a few, to recap on just a few that we've talked about over the last half hour or so. If atheism is true, you and I are nothing more than animals. Gone is human significance. There is nothing special about humanity. We are just another animal. And as one atheist writer put it, you know, quite frankly, she said, a rat is a pig, is a dog, is a boy. They are all mammals. Of course, if you really believe that, what happens when you start living that out? What happens if you can see your fellow human beings as just animals? What's wrong with treating them that way? If good and evil are mere fictions, mere tricks of the mind, mere social constructions, then why worry about the way we treat people? And what do we say to victims of injustice? We simply say, well, that's the universe, mate. Blind, pitiless indifference. Sorry, you didn't do so well. Most of us would see that as a pretty horrifying conclusion. All of this follows if atheism is true. One of the most influential atheist, Bertrand Russell was one. Another very influential atheist in the last century was a gentleman called Friedrich Nietzsche. Some of you who have read around these things may have heard of him. And unlike people like Richard Dawkins and the contemporary new atheists, who are in some ways, I like to say, trying to sort of advance a kind of sort of cuddly, friendly, not tested on animals, fluffy pink version of atheism. I like these older generation of atheists because they're more realistic. And Nietzsche said something very helpful to us as Christians. He made this admission in one of his books. He said, when you give up the Christian faith, you pull the right to Christian morality out from under your feet. This morality is by no means self-evident. This point has to be exhibited again and again, despite the English flatheads. We'll allow him that. Christianity, he says, is a system, a whole view of things thought out together. By breaking one part of it, the belief in God, nothing necessary remains in your hands. That's a hugely important point for atheists to get their heads around. It's a phenomenally important point for Christians to get their head around. Because I meet far too many Christians who live out their Christian faith in a tiny little bubble. Christianity affects how you go to church, the friends that you have, you read Christian books, Christian literature, hang out with Christians, never once think through the implications of the Christian faith for anything bigger. But if he's right, and I think that he is, if the Christian faith is true, it affects everything. Every question that matters hangs on whether God exists. If God does not exist, there is no answer to these big questions of existence, and everything is meaningless. It's not a choice of, I believe in God, and it maybe affects a few things. If you believe in God, it affects everything, or it should do. It should also, quite frankly, excite us, because if you sit there and you think your Christian faith is this big, no wonder you're going to find it hard to get motivated in the morning. If you sit there and you reflect on how important the Christian faith is, how massive the implications are, that should motivate you even more to want to share the love of Christ with our atheist friends who don't know anything like that because of the implications that it makes. One of my favorite writers of all time is another Russian novelist whose name was Alexander Solzhenitsyn. A few of you may have heard of him. He is arguably the most influential writer of the 20th century. Not merely a novelist and a political commentator, his works arguably helped bring about the end of communism. And in one of his writings, he wrote this little line. And this quotation on the screen behind me, many people think is possibly the most quoted line from any 20th century writer anywhere. It's been quoted by millions and millions and millions of other people. It's hugely influential. And he wrote this. He said, the dividing line between good and evil runs right through the middle of every human heart. What he was saying was, he said, we have a tendency as human beings to think that, you know, some people are good and some people are bad, and it's all about sort of things like political systems or ideologies or those kind of things. And he said, well, actually, he said, the basic problem of human existence is each one of us, every single human being, has the ability to be good or the ability to be bad. We have the ability to be a saint or a sinner. We have the ability to be generous, the ability to be monstrous. And if you've reflected honestly on who you are this evening, you should know this to be true. Maybe you love to come to church here and your friends look at you and they think you're wonderful and holy, but your family know that at home you're vicious and vindictive and you can backbite people when their backs are turned. We can all do this. I do this. Just ask my wife. All of us have this tendency to reflect this. And so we need a worldview that can address this. I think the most important thing we need is a worldview, a belief system, an ideology that addresses that brokenness in the human heart. Because every single one of us wrestle with this. I do, you do, and Richard Dawkins certainly does. And atheism doesn't answer that question. Atheism can't touch this question. Yet it's the question that most of us need to wrestle with. And I would say the fundamental problem with atheism is it's unlivable. You can't live atheism out. You have to smuggle in answers from elsewhere. And I regularly challenge my atheist friends when they start talking about morality or goodness or purpose or any of these things. I love to look them in the eye and go, you're sounding increasingly like a Christian, because that's not a consistent atheist position. Earlier, middle of last year, I got an email from a student at the University of Toronto who'd come across my contact information somewhere. And he emailed me and he said, Andy, I wonder if you could take me out to lunch because I have some questions about the Christian faith. I read that email and I thought, that's the wrong way round, really, but never mind. I took him out to lunch and I treated him to a really good experience. I took him to Swiss Chalet. I know how to show people a good time. And Over the course of about 2 hours, he proceeded to fire question after question after question at me. He was an atheist and a pretty enthusiastic one. And I would answer one question, he would answer, he'd ask another, and another, and another, and another. I think we got through about 47 different questions in those 2 hours. And I didn't really shift his atheism. And as we were leaving the restaurant and walking across the parking lot to his car, I found myself praying and sort of saying to the Lord, you know, I need something that I can leave him with. I just want him to leave him with something that he might think about, because it feels like every answer I've given has kind of bounced off him. And as we got to his car, a thought popped into my head. As he opened the door to his car, I said, well, I hope you've enjoyed this lunchtime. And he said, yeah, it's been great. And I said, well, I hope that, you know, some of the questions I answered were helpful. But I said, in particular, I hope that you felt I treated you with respect and dignity. Although you're an atheist, I hope you felt that I didn't belittle you or insult you or rude, anything like that. And he said, no, you were very, very kind. You were very generous. I said, well, that's great. I said, I'm glad to hear that. I said, I have to say that you've treated me the same way. I said, as an atheist, you weren't rude, you weren't belligerent. Thank you for that. And he said, oh, that's very kind of you. And then came the kicker. I said, you know, though, the reason I treated you with respect and dignity and the things that thankfully you recognized is I believe that you are made in the image of God and have supreme value. I believe you are not just another animal, but are a person with dignity and value who God uniquely created and loves so much that he sent his son to die for you. And that's what I tried to reflect. And I'm glad that came across. So here's the interesting thing. You have told me this lunchtime, in fact, three times, you've told me that you believe that human beings are just matter and molecules and atoms. Yet you haven't treated me like a collection of molecules and atoms. You've treated me like a human being made in the image of God with value and dignity. In other words, you spent 2 hours treating me on the basis of my beliefs, not of yours. And for that, I am eternally grateful. For the first time in 2 hours, he had absolutely nothing to say. Why, in conclusion, am I not an atheist? I think that story kind of hints at it for me. I'm not an atheist because I consistently see in the lives of my atheist friends that they are kind of, in the words of that famous U2 song, still haven't found what they're looking for. That despite the protestations, that there is still something deeper going on, and they are looking for something else. And the thing I like to tell my atheist friends is, look, atheism is not the only game in town. There are really so many ways that you can be a thought through, consistent, argued out individual and not be an atheist. There is another worldview vastly different from the atheist one with, quite frankly, more evidence going for it. And that's the Christian worldview. Because as a Christian, I say, I look at those questions, origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. And I say, look, if you want to know the answer to some of the most profound questions about humankind it is possible to ask, then you have got to start from the God who made us and designed us. Otherwise, you are going to end up in real trouble. And the exciting thing I say to my atheist friends is you don't need to look very hard for God, because in Jesus Christ, he has come looking for us. And our challenge, I believe, brothers and sisters who love Christ, the challenge for us is to engage our atheist friends, befriend them, not be afraid of them, reach out to them, break out of our Christian bubble. If this evening you don't have any friends who are atheists, my challenge to you is to get some. Because if you don't, who will tell them of a God like this? We don't need to be afraid of atheist questions. We can engage them with depth, with clarity, with integrity, and compassion. God loves atheists. Jesus died for atheists. And let's pray that he might use some of us to reach our atheist friends with the gospel. With that, Bill, over to you.